This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's top rights official dismisses a Swedish court ruling against Iranian national Hamid Nouri as unlawful, saying Tehran has several options on the table to respond to. The Syrian military says it has intercepted a new Israeli strike on the capital Damascus, shooting down most of the enemy's missiles. And Moscow says the latest round of EU sanctions on Russia's gold imports and its top lender will have devastating consequences for global economy and security. Thank you for joining us. Iran's top human rights official has denounced what he calls the contradictory behavior and double standard policies of some European countries toward the Islamic Republic. The secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights made the comment in protest at a Swedish court ruling against Iranian national Hamid Nouri. Qasem Gharibabadi called the verdict unlawful, saying Tehran will not sit idly by and has several options on the table to respond to. Gharibabadi said Sweden claims to be behaving based on mutual respect, but hosts and supports anti-Iran terror groups. Last week, a Swedish court sentenced Nouri to life in prison over alleged rights abuses against members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization known as the MKO in the 1980s. The MKO is a terror group responsible for thousands of deaths in Iran. Syrian media say Israel has conducted fresh missile strikes on the country, targeting areas on the outskirts of the capital, Damascus. The regime's warplanes reportedly fired missiles from the occupied Golan Heights. Syrian military sources have been quoted as saying that air defenses intercepted most of the incoming missiles. They say the attack left three soldiers dead, seven more injured, and caused material damage. The Israeli regime frequently launches missile attacks on Syria, mainly targeting its military and resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Syria has time and again denounced Israeli acts of aggression and lodged official complaints with the UN and other international bodies for violating its sovereignty. Damascus says it reserves the right to respond to the Israeli aggression. As the Russian army advances in the north of Donbass, our reporter Johnny Miller travels to the front line outside the Ukrainian stronghold of Avdiivka on the outskirts of the city of Donetsk.
I'm heading with pro-Russian forces to the front line, just outside the city of Donetsk. We move at a fast pace, as there is constant incoming and outgoing at these positions. Suddenly we are told to run, as we reach open ground. The pro-Russians had just fired a heavy artillery barrage. The Ukrainians will most likely respond in kind. We reach the trenches. Opposing them is the Ukrainian stronghold of Avdiivka. For 8 years, the Ukrainians have been digging in, creating a complex network of underground bunkers. It will be one of the greatest challenges for Russia in this war so far. This fighter is an Abkhazi volunteer from the south of Russia. I asked him why he came to fight in Donbass.
It's our common sacred task to stand by Russia. We understand that an unjust war is going on. This territory is Russian land. Unfortunately, NATO and the USA are trying to make use of the collapse of the USSR. And you see the results of this work. Unfortunately, people die in war. And Russians and Ukrainians are fraternal peoples.
Now, about a month ago, I was in a frontline position not far from here, and it was pretty quiet. Now, the situation has changed as the pro-Russian forces here are trying to move forward into different positions. The Russian army is far to the north of here. There's a feeling that before making a full push, they will wait for the Russian army to come down and help to encircle Avdiivka. But for the moment, they're trying to keep the Ukrainian positions occupied. That's why there's so much incoming and outgoing from this position.
While NATO and Ukraine have been declaring for months that morale is low this side of the battle lines, all the pro-Russian fighters I've spoken to over 2 months here clearly have high morale. They are in no doubt they will take Avdiivka soon, as well as the rest of Donbass. And they believe they are fighting for a worthy cause.
They know perfectly well Russia doesn't target civilians, so they set up their positions where civilians are. We have sympathy for these civilians, but we will liberate them. And for those who force the Ukrainians to fight, for the Nazis, we do not have any sympathy. The card, as ever, was played by the Americans. It should be realized, Ukraine doesn't need this war. Their minds are not clear. They were left no choice but to fight by NATO.
While Ukraine is putting up a fierce defense in Donbass, the advantage is Russia's, with its overwhelming artillery superiority. As this conflict approaches its sixth month, soldiers are dying for each kilometer of land. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Now, Russia says the latest round of EU sanctions is illegitimate, warning that it would have devastating consequences for various segments of the global economy and security. The foreign ministry has accused the EU of continuing to, quote, drive itself into a dead end with enviable persistence. The new sanctions include a ban on importing gold from Russia and freezing the assets of the country's top lender, Sberbank. On Wednesday, EU diplomats agreed on a new round of sanctions over Moscow's military offensive in Ukraine. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, in a statement condemned the move, saying there is a huge gap between the EU's declared intentions and its actual behavior. The bloc has already imposed a wave of sanctions on Russia, targeting its key sectors. Ukraine and Russia are set to sign a Turkey-mediated deal that would allow Kiev to resume its Black Sea grain exports. Details of the agreement, due to be signed on Friday, were not immediately known, but the office of the Turkish president says a general agreement was reached on a UN-led plan during talks in Istanbul last week. There was no immediate official confirmation either from Moscow or Kiev. Over 25 million tons of wheat and other stuff have been blocked in several Ukrainian ports by Russian warships and landmines planted by Ukraine itself to avert Russia's offensive. Russia and Ukraine are both major global wheat suppliers, but grain shipments have stalled since Russia launched its military operation against Kiev in February, an act which has fueled a global food crisis. As the contest to become Britain's next prime minister reaches its final stage, just two contenders are left to battle it out to become successor to the outgoing Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. With the race developing quickly over the past week, Robert Carter explains what to expect next in this tense moment for UK politics.
Five rounds of voting by UK Conservative MPs have produced the final two candidates for party leader. It's now down to Tory party members to decide who will be the next leader of not just their own party, but the country too. The finalists, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, are lining up for their final showdown to become Boris Johnson's successor. The winner set to be announced on September the 5th, following a vote among the 160,000 or so members.
While members have been given a full month to vote, experience from past similar postal ballots suggests that many members will probably decide on who they want to vote for immediately, casting their ballots as soon as they get the chance to do so. So that means that the two candidates will have to rely on a rapid, hard-hitting initial start to their campaign in order to try and grab as many to their side as they possibly can.
The Conservative dogfight has raised concerns within Tory ranks that bitter divides are being exposed to the public, further damaging the party's overall image.
The comments made in the debates were really more personal in nature and really relating to people's performance and particular minutiae of policy. There aren't really substantial differences in the Conservative Party. There may be slight disagreements on where you shouldn't have put the taxes up or you should have originally been a Leaver, but now they're all signed up to taking Britain through the Brexit process, which, contrary to some, is still continuing because there's unfinished business from leaving the European Union. But really the differences are slight and have been somewhat exaggerated.
The two candidates must now travel across the country and tackle questions from members. With the economy in crisis, party reputation on the rocks, and even greater issues with foreign policy, whoever wins will have serious work to do. Robert Carter, London.
Now to Sri Lanka, where security forces have raided the main anti-government protest camp in the capital, Colombo, evicting activists gathered outside the president's office. Troops and police commandos in riot gear swooped in on the protesters hours before they were due to vacate the area themselves. Soldiers also removed barricades set up by protesters near the main gate of the office. The raid came a day after veteran politician Ranil Wickremesinghe was sworn in as the crisis hit country's new president. He replaced Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who was forced to step down and flee the country amid protests over an unprecedented economic crisis earlier this month. The new president faces an uphill task of steering the country out of its worst crisis ever. Over to Sudan, one more protester has been killed by security forces after people took to the streets to call for an end to the military rule. Medical sources aligned with the protest movement say the protester was fatally shot in Omdurman, a city close to the capital, Khartoum. That brings to 115 the number of people killed during protests against a coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan in October last year. The putsch ousted a civilian group that was tasked with forming an interim administration. Earlier this month, Burhan took a surprise move and vowed to make room for a new transitional government. The pledge was met with skepticism by critics, including the main civilian bloc known as the Forces for Freedom of Change. Sudan has been in the grip of unrest since the ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Iran's central city of Rafsanjan is hosting an international talent contest dubbed Stage Stars. The event is aimed at providing a chance for stage talents to come to light. Yusuf Shaladi reports from Rafsanjan.
They can make people laugh, impersonate voices, or sing. This is a stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey, to get on stage and perform in Iran's city of Rafsanjan.
I come from Bangladesh. I have participated in the hosting section. It's an amazing festival for the likes of me who pursue their dreams.
I am participating from Iraq. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to show my talent here in this event.
I have to represent our culture, Indian culture, and when I was in the start in the Tehran, then how I managed to live because I didn't know the Persian language.
The contest has four categories of singing: stand-up comedy, show hosting, and sound impression. Contestants say this stage provides a shortcut to their success.
I'm so happy to be able to take part in this international talent contest. It provides a great opportunity for stage talents to be seen and shine in their favorite fields.
Stage Stars is a good chance for singers, sound impressionists, and stand-up comedians to be discovered. It's a big leg up for them.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say only their real talents will be picked for the top prize.
This is a competition between the professionals of stage performance. There is no chance for a mistake. Each contestant here has a strong background in their expertise, so this stage is not the starting point, but a milestone for their careers.
One interesting part of this festival is the participation of international talents, who are mainly students from other countries who study in Iran. There's a separate competition dedicated for foreign participants.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival. The top performances from each category will win the golden mic, plus a cash prize.
Organizers say this contest seeks to scout for those who really have a knack for stage performance and to bring them under the spotlight. So to those who nab the golden mic here, this stage is a springboard toward their ambitions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
The Iranian president has hosted his Turkish and Russian counterparts for a summit on the crisis in Syria. As much as Syria was the focus of the gathering, there was another positive result to come out of the summit: how Iran, Russia, and Turkey can solve regional issues. One of the challenges discussed was how to convince Turkey not to pursue its military operation against Kurds in northern Syria. And that's what Iran's leader conveyed to the Turkish president.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-à-vis its neighbor Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognized there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
While Biden pledges allegiance to Israeli regime, thousands of Palestinians in the Masafer Yatta region of the occupied West Bank are facing imminent forced expulsions from their homes. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Marjorie Khan, journalist. This article is published under the heading Palestinians face forced expulsions as Biden pledges allegiance to Israeli regime. Here's more. Pro President Joe Biden's much-heralded visit to Al-Quds has confirmed that the United States remains the Zionist regime's enabler-in-chief. Biden promised to continue providing the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion in annual military aid, more than the U.S. gives any other country, to maintain the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. Pledging to stand with the Jewish Israel, Biden ignored the exclusion of the Palestinian people from Israel, which extends only to Jewish people. Palestinians do not enjoy the same democratic rights as Jews. As Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, an Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, recently affirmed, the Israeli regime is an apartheid regime. After Biden arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport, the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Yair Lapid called him a great Zionist and one of the best friends Israel has ever known. Biden said, "You do not need to be a Jew to be a Zionist." The Zionist regime is a Jewish theocracy whose Zionist government was created on Palestinian land. In the newly released U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Joint Declaration, Biden and Lapid affirmed that they will continue to work together to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court. That means the Biden administration commits to opposing to constitutionally protect, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, affirming Israeli regime's illegal claim of self-defense against Palestinians under its occupation, stymieing the International Criminal Court's investigation of Israeli regime war crimes, and voting against any criticism of Israeli regime in the UN General Assembly. While Biden pledges allegiance to the Zionist regime, thousands of Palestinians in the Masafer Yatta region of the occupied West Bank are facing imminent forced expulsions from their homes. Although this would violate the Geneva Conventions, Biden has not condemned it in spite of protests by U.S. Jewish organizations and 100 U.S. Congress members. Biden would not meet with the people of Masafer Yatta or any other Palestinian community whose homes are threatened with demolition funded by U.S. tax dollars. Biden's visit comes on the heels of the U.S. government's whitewashing of the Zionist regime's assassination of beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, who reported for Al Jazeera for 25 years. Although the U.S. concluded she was likely killed by the Israeli regime military, the U.S. said it had no reason to believe the killing was intentional, but rather the result of tragic circumstances. Abu Aghaleh, who was wearing a helmet and vest labeled "Press," was shot below her ear, the only part of her face that was unprotected. Al Jazeera journalist Shatta Hanasha, who also wore a helmet and vest marked as "Press," said the soldiers did not stop firing even after Abu Aghaleh collapsed. The army was adamant on shooting to kill. A CNN forensic investigation cited explosive weapons expert Chris Cobb Smith, who concluded that the number of strike marks on the tree where Abu Aghaleh was standing proves this wasn't a random shot. She was targeted. In a letter sent to Biden in advance of his visit, Abu Aghaleh's family charged that the United States has been skulking toward the erasure of any wrongdoing by Israeli forces. 2 weeks before Israeli regime forces assassinated Abu Aghaleh, three leading Palestinian journalist organizations filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court that accused the Zionist regime of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. But Biden refused to meet with Abu Aghaleh's family while he was in the region. Biden has refused to reverse other Trump actions that pandered to the Zionist regimes as well. He has not withdrawn Trump's illegal recognition of Al-Quds as the capital of the fake regime of Israel, nor has he rescinded Trump's declaration of legitimacy of illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank or reopened the Palestinian mission in Washington. Biden's visit to the occupied Palestinian territories demonstrates the scant difference between his administration and Trump's in their uncritical, unwavering support for the fabricated regime of Israel. Using American people's tax dollars, the U.S. regime continues to enable Israeli regime's illegal and brutal occupation of Palestinian lands.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. I'm pretty sure we've discussed this before, either on this segment or some other shows, but you can never talk about it enough, really. An Islamic lifestyle, one that a woman can implement into her everyday life, into her routine, and that would bring her a sense of satisfaction, a sense of satiation, you know, that she'd feel fulfilled in her life. I think that's so important. Because at the end of the day, what are we trying to do except find meaning in life?
We want to feel that we are living for a purpose.
Yes.
Otherwise, you see that sometimes, you know, shaitan comes in our mind and we feel that, why did we come to this world in the first place? But if you have a purpose and a goal, we'll always look at the end, the goal. That, no, I want Allah to be happy with me. I want to prosper because Allah has kept a place for me in Jannah. He wants me to live there forever.
Beautiful.
This world is just like a bridge to pass. We have to collect the good deeds and go there in the long run. So it doesn't mean that, you know, we have to be miserable in this world. Plus Allah says that even treat your nafs, part of your day should go in giving those treats to yourself to feel happy about it, you know. Because we are so much attached to this nature. Our body is inclined to, you know, this kind of nature that is outside, eating, drinking, getting happy, friends, social life. Allah said, no, it's halal, enjoy. But don't spend your time,
it's
everything in that.
Goal.
And have a rule to have an aim behind these things.
Yeah, it's not your objective.
Yes, only we have to be alert.
Yeah.
The point is to be alert that why are you doing this? Alert in all matters, the worldly and the hereafterly. Otherwise, sometimes the worldly matters, if you're alert, you earn so much sawabs, more than the hereafterly, where you don't practice that being alert. You're just doing it out of habituation.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
So everything requires that alertness. Now here, a woman has, of course, again, a very great, big, beautiful role to play at home. And how to make a lifestyle like a preparation ground for the betterment of the society. First, when she gets married. And that's between the spouses, how she acts with her spouse. So there are two things that are very important when the man and the woman enjoy this right. A woman has the right to be loved and to be taken care of. A man has the right to be respected. So these two things are like two pillars to give rise to a generation who have love in their hearts and who have respect for the people to make, you know, like everything go swiftly in every way among their children, with the people, in the society, you know, your relationships with people, how you want the betterment for the people, how you want their progress. All of it revolves around love and respect. And that is, those are the lessons you yourself practice with your husband first.
Beautiful.
So you deserve that love. It's very important for a man to even express his love. And Hadith says that when you do express this love, it does never come out from her heart. It's the way she is, you know. She appreciates that. And Halid Deen Illal Hub. Deen is all about love. If you go and see, we have the master character in us to want to express love and to feel loved. And then there's another side of it. A man, he needs that respect. He needs to be shown that respect. He's the authoritative one. He's the authority of the house. So with these two things, you're building a very good society. And a man and woman should compete in this. You know, like who is giving more love and who is giving more respect. So it's very important. As-sabiqoon, as-sabiqoon, ulaik al-muqarrabun. And that's preparing for the zuhur of Imam Zamana. He wants the muqarrabin to be the leaders, right? The 313. And then when this comes about and you see strong relationships like this giving rise to offsprings that are so like, mashallah, they are so successful at home, in their akhlaq, with their respect towards their parents, and outside also. They are so like successful in every way. People love them because of their good akhlaq. They show respect to people and they move forward. The society loves them. So respect and love is fused in them. Through what? That society that is built in the smallest unit of the home. And that's what spreading the Islamic lifestyle.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, sisters, brothers, ladies, gentlemen. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio.
When we are bringing up children, the best miras and inheritance you can leave is the good manners.
Absolutely.
Adab is the best miras to give the children. It's good because they have a sense of confidence in them also. When people respect them around them, that what a mashallah, respectful person this, what a kind person, what a loving person, they gain that self-confidence that I'm appreciated. So it moves on. And then another thing that is so important, that is Islamic lifestyle, is being organized at home. Nazm. Right. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam in his deathbed said,
Nazm fi umurikum.
Al-Quran, Nazm fi umurikum, right? That means in all the matters, organization is very important. And Allah, alhamdulillah, has given us such a beautiful timetable, our five daily prayer. That starts off with Nazm, you know? And such a Nazm that we have to be aware of all the timings in the right ways and also prepare. That we are, you know, like when we are praying, we are conversing with Allah. So if we sit around, then we have not prayed the proper prayer. And in fact, the prayer's outlet is that it makes you stronger in faith also. It makes you more fearful. It makes you more alert. It makes you more, you know, aware of what you're doing. Because you don't want that prayer to be wasted. Okay? Having a timetable for yourself, that is the spiritual timetable. And that when you do have, you'll see that you'll have an organized timetable for your children as well. That you know your children, how it's naturally the mother to see the timetable of a child. It's very important also when the baby is born that the mother keeps the timetable of the child. That you know, it's so and so times this child will need to be fed, to be nursed. And so time, this child has a nap. And so time, this child needs to play. So it's so natural to love that Nazm, that organization, you know. Yeah, the routine should be used so beautifully that you feel a sense of achievement at the end of the day. But everything goes wrong and you don't know, okay, so my baby, why is he crying? Okay, maybe he's this, maybe he's that. You don't feed him properly, or you go out at that time and leave it to the husband, or you find a nurse, you know, to take care of the child. You'll see everything going so wrong, you know, in the life of a child. Mm. So it starts with when a mother has this child whom she loves so much, whom she has the natural inclination to get a timetable for. So Allah loves us more than that. He wants us to also develop this timetable, the spiritual and physical timetable.
Yeah, because we need stability.
Yes.
That's one of the most fundamental things a child needs during the early stages of their lives. And we all started at that point as children. And we need stability. We need something that we can depend on in terms of it creating a structure for our lives. And only through that can we have the, like you said, the confidence and the inner peace to navigate through life. Yeah. You take that away from a child because you don't know how to parent right, or because you can't even stick to your religious routines and schedules. And not only did you ruin your akhirah, you ruined this child's dunya as well.
And then you'll see such children, they're complaining of boredom.
Yes.
And so I'm often bored. Yes, I'm bored. So, you know, like I usually use this method that, you know, when before they even have the chance to say that we are bored, like the night before you tell them tomorrow we have a very long day. We're going to do this, we're going to do that,
yes,
we're going to do this and that. So we have four things in our agenda and they're all useful. So it's like you look forward
they're
to it.
They're already looking forward.
Yeah, they're
to
all.
It.
Yes. They don't have time to be bored, you
exactly
see. So like if we want to read the next day, we'll say that we have a class tomorrow and then we're going to read this book and then you're going to play for a while and then again we're going to go, for example, out for a while and then we're going to go to the mosque and when we come back, we'll be so tired that we're going to sleep.
Exactly.
So it's like a whole timetable being built and it's so important. I remember that when I was young, I used to complain of boredom a lot. And I used to feel that I don't know what to do with my time. And just the idle mind is the devil's workshop, you see.
Totally.
So it's so important to not repeat this mistake. And I felt that, why am I bored? When there's so many things to do. I have so many books to read. But I guess, you know, with like sometimes the surroundings around you, so many kids around you, somehow lack of knowledge. Your parents don't know the very right thing to do at that time. Maybe overwhelmed with the situation, maybe no helper around them. So it's not their fault. But now we could do a favor for them to bring their generation, give the generation quality.
Yep.
Right? So we want to give their generation quality by realizing all these things and making it better for them, the kids. So it's very important to have the nazm always. Nazm fi umurikum,
yes,
in our lives. In the lives of our weekly duties also, preparing a timetable for cooking so that you don't have an excuse to say, what do I cook? Always have a timetable that, for example, if, you know, a general timetable, I'm going to have meat twice a day. I'm going to cook meat twice a day. Or sometimes I'm going to cook for 2 days. You know, I'm going to cook in such a way with the consent of the people around you that I'm going to eat for 2 days. It's okay because I'm busy, right? And you have the permission.
Have a plan.
Yeah,
just
you have a plan.
Have a plan.
I need to do some reading.
Yeah.
So when you do have a plan, you go so swiftly and you feel time is so much barakat, so much like blessings that you can do so many things during a day. And you feel so blessed. You feel so happy.
So fulfilled.
Yeah, so fulfilled.
Young people who are struggling with what direction to take in life, they go to a counselor or a therapist or whatever. The first thing that person would say is that have a routine, have a schedule, wake up and go to bed at a certain time.
Yeah.
Start somewhere.
At least know what you're going to do during the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Something fruitful, something that will give you pleasure, happiness, that's the right thing, that will make you grow in perfection, that you would feel useful, that you're doing something that makes you happy. inshallah, that we use ourselves, our time in the best, the appropriate manner and not waste the time. It's so much stressed in Quran, you know, by the time Allah swears. Why this time? Because it's our capital, our asset, that every time we, like even now, moment by moment, I'm getting closer to my death.
Mm.
So it's inevitable that it's going. But if I'm compensating it with good deeds, then I get a better capital, you know, that capital that is lost. Allah wants a better capital for you.
Yep.
And yeah, that's absolutely through these things that you use your time in the, you know, with ibadah, wal isale, calling people towards truth, calling people towards sabr, and enjoining, you know, people towards patience and things like that. So, inshallah, with all this, Islam is replete with so many good things for us, so many teachings through ahadith, Quran. We just have to open our hearts, as I time and again say, towards these things, and we'll see that we are moving forward, having a beautiful life. And having that qana'at, that feeling of satisfaction that we were born for the right purpose. Otherwise, you know, it's like sometimes you feel that, why am I doing this?
Why do I bother even?
Yeah, why do I bother?
Oh, it's
and then you waste yourself
feeling.
and you feel so left out. And if you keep on, it brings so much hopelessness now within you, which is gunai kabira, and then it takes you towards, God forbid, a person may feel that,
so many suicidal
end my life.
Thoughts, yeah, yeah, that people are having sadly in the world is because they're thinking, why do I bother?
Yeah.
What's the meaning of any of this? And I'm not saying that, oh, just fix your iman and everything's going to be all right. It comes with knowledge. It comes with practice, with patience,
yeah,
with help and support.
Iman.
Yes. And all of that is so very important. And we are so out of time. Thank you so very much, Sister Salma, for your insight. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, climate change and rapid population growth are shrinking the Great Salt Lake, creating a bowl of toxic dust that could poison the air around Salt Lake City. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falvell. The piece is titled, As the Great Salt Lake Dries Up, Utah Faces an Environmental Nuclear Bomb. If the Great Salt Lake in the United States, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, here's what's in store. The lake's flies and brine shrimp would die off. Scientists warn it could start as soon as this summer, threatening the 10 million migratory birds that stop at the lake annually to feed on the tiny creatures. Ski conditions at the resorts above Salt Lake City, a vital source of revenue, would deteriorate. The lucrative extraction of magnesium and other minerals from the lake could stop. Most alarming, the air surrounding Salt Lake City, Utah, would occasionally turn poisonous. The lake bed contains high levels of arsenic, and as more of it becomes exposed, windstorms carry that arsenic into the lungs of nearby residents, who make up three-quarters of Utah's population. We have this potential environmental nuclear bomb that's going to go off if we don't take some pretty dramatic action, said Joel Ferry, a Republican state lawmaker and rancher who lives on the north side of the Great Salt Lake. As climate change continues to cause record-breaking drought, there are no easy solutions. Saving the Great Salt Lake would require letting more snow melt from the mountains flow to the lake, which means less water for residents and farmers. That would threaten the region's breakneck population growth and high-value agriculture, something that state leaders seem reluctant to do. Utah's dilemma raises a core question as the country heats up. How quickly are Americans willing to adapt to the effects of climate change, even if those effects become urgent, obvious, and potentially catastrophic? The stakes are alarmingly high, according to Timothy Hawks, a Republican lawmaker who wants more aggressive action. Otherwise, he said, the Great Salt Lake risks the same fate as California's Owens Lake, which went dry decades ago, producing the worst levels of dust pollution in the United States and helping to turn the nearby community into a veritable ghost town. It's not just fear-mongering, he said, of the lake vanishing. It can actually happen. Say you climbed into a car at the edge of the Pacific Ocean and started driving east, tracing a line across the middle of the United States. After crossing the Klamath and Cascade Mountains in Northern California, green and lush, you would reach the Great Basin Desert of Nevada and western Utah. In one of the driest parts of the United States, the landscape is a brown so pale it's almost grey. But keep going east, and just shy of Wyoming, you would find a modern oasis. A narrow strip of green, stretching some 100 miles from north to south, home to an uninterrupted metropolis beneath snow-capped mountains, sheltered under maple and pear trees. At the edge of that oasis, between the city and the desert, is the Great Salt Lake. Utahns called the metropolis the Wasatch Front, after the 12,000-foot Wasatch Range above it. Extending roughly from Provo in the south to Brigham City in the north, with Salt Lake City at its center, it's one of the fastest-growing urban areas in the United States, home to 2.5 million people, drawn by the natural beauty and relatively modest cost of living. That megacity is possible because of a minor hydrological miracle. Snow that falls in the mountains just east of Salt Lake City feeds three rivers, the Jordan, the Weber, and the Bear, which provide water for the cities and towns of the Wasatch Front, as well as the rich cropland nearby, before flowing into the Great Salt Lake. Until recently, that hydrological system existed in a delicate balance. In summer, evaporation would cause the lake to drop about 2 feet in level. In spring, as the snowpack melted, the rivers would replenish it. Now two changes are throwing that system out of balance. One is explosive population growth, diverting more water from those rivers before they reach the Great Salt Lake. The other shift is climate change, according to Robert Gillies, a professor at Utah State University and Utah State climatologist. Higher temperatures cause more snowpack to transform to water vapor, which then escapes into the atmosphere rather than turning to liquid and running into rivers. More heat also means greater demand for water for lawns and crops, further reducing the amount that reaches the Great Salt Lake. And a shrinking lake means less snow. As storms pass over the Great Salt Lake, they absorb some of the moisture, which then falls as snow in the mountains. A vanishing lake endangers that pattern. If you don't have water, Dr. Robert Gillies says, you don't have industry, you don't have agriculture, and you don't have life. Last summer, as the water level in the Great Salt Lake reached its lowest point on record, and it's likely to fall further even this year, the lake surface area, which covered about 3,300 square miles in the late 1980s, has since shrunk to less than 1,000 square miles, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The salt content in the part of the lake closest to Salt Lake City used to fluctuate between 9% and 12%, according to Bonnie Baxter, a biology professor at Westminster College. But as the water in the lake drops, its salt content has increased. If it reaches 17%, something that Dr. Baxter says will happen this summer, the algae in the water will struggle, threatening the brine shrimp that consume it. While the ecosystem hasn't collapsed yet, Dr. Baxter says, we're at the precipice, and it's terrifying. The long-term risks are even worse. One morning in March, Kevin Perry, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, walked out onto land that used to be underwater. He picked at the earth, the color of dried mud, like a beach whose tide went out and never came back. The soil contains arsenic, antimony, copper, zirconium, and other dangerous heavy metals, much of it residue from mining activity in the region. Most of the exposed soil is still protected by a hard crust. But as wind erodes the crust over time, those contaminants become airborne. Clouds of dust also make it difficult for people to breathe, particularly those with asthma or other respiratory ailments. Dr. Perry pointed to shards of crust that had come apart, lying on the sand like broken china. This is a disaster, Dr. Perry said, and the consequences for the ecosystem are absolutely insanely bad. In theory, the fix is simple. Let more water from melting snowpack reach the Great Salt Lake by sending less water towards homes, businesses and farms. But metropolitan Salt Lake City has barely enough water to support its current population, and it is expected to grow almost 50% by 2060. The worst-case scenario for the Great Salt Lake is neither hypothetical nor abstract. Rather, it's on display 600 miles southwest, in a narrow valley at the edge of California, where what used to be a lake is now a barely contained disaster. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles, growing fast and running out of water, bought land along either side of the Owens River, then built an aqueduct diverting the river's water 230 miles south to Los Angeles. The river had been the main source of water for what was once Owens Lake, which covered more than 100 square miles. The lake dried up, and then for much of the 20th century, it was the worst source of dust pollution in America, according to a 2020 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. When windstorms hit the dried lake bed, they pick up PM10, particulate matter 10 micrometers or smaller, which can lodge in the lungs when inhaled and has been linked to worsened asthma, heart attacks and premature deaths. The amount of PM10 in the air around Owens Lake has been as much as 138 times higher than deemed safe by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Local officials successfully sued the city of Los Angeles, arguing it had violated the rights of nearby communities to clean air. A judge ordered Los Angeles to reduce the dust. That was 25 years ago. Since then, the city of Los Angeles has spent $2.5 billion trying to keep wind from blowing dust off the lake bed. The city has tried different strategies, covering the lake bed in gravel, spraying just enough water on the dust to hold it in place, constantly tilling the dry earth, creating low ridges to catch restive dust particles before they can become airborne. The result is a mix between an industrial site and a science experiment. On a recent morning, workers scurried across the vast area checking valves and sprinklers that continually get plugged with sand. Nearby, inside a complex that resembles a bunker, walls of screens monitor data to alert the operation's 70-person staff if something goes wrong. If the carefully calibrated flow of sprinklers is disrupted, for example, dust could quickly start to fly off again. Dust levels near the lake still sometimes exceed federal safety rules among Utah's coterie of nervous advocates for the Great Salt Lake. Owens Lake has become shorthand for the risk of failing to act quickly enough and the grave damage if the lake dries up, the contents of its bed spinning into the air. Of what used to be shore of what used to be Owens Lake is what's left of the town of Keeler. When the lake still existed, the town of Keeler was a boom town. Today it consists of an abandoned school, an abandoned train station, a long-closed general store, a post office that's open from 10 a.m. to noon, and about 50 remaining residents who value their space and have lots of it. Cheap land, said Jim Macy when asked why he moved to Keeler in 1980. He described that period before Los Angeles began trying to hold down the lake bed as the time of dust. He recalled watching entire houses vanish from sight when the wind blew in. We called it the Keeler Death Cloud, Mr. Macy said.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio, Coming up is the news.